This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
I'm Ben Gideon.
Hey, Ben. So I don't know if we talked about this during the podcast, but I learned from you that it actually doesn't snow that much in Maine. But I saw some Facebook footage of you and your daughter skiing just the other day, and it looked amazing.
Yeah, so I had a really great run of things. I was just telling Karen offline that I was out in Big Sky, Montana, skiing with a group, some trial lawyers included, last week, and then flew home on Thursday, drove immediately up to Sugarloaf without even stopping at my home in Freeport, and skied Friday, Saturday, Sunday up there. And on Saturday night, we had 2 feet of new snow. So the video that you saw of me skiing with my daughter was on Sunday after the new snow. So we had a rare Northeast powder day. Probably also rare that we had more snow in Maine than we had out in Montana when I was out there skiing. They definitely could use some more snow at Big Sky. But overall, really fun trip.
Oh, that's too bad.
You were invited, Rahul, but you blew us off.
I know. I had my 15-year-old's birthday, so I wasn't able to make it. But the same one that gave that fantastic speech of mine.
Yeah. So if you haven't listened to the last episode, Rahul's son is featured giving the speech at Rahul's 50th birthday party. They did a great job editing out all the pauses in that. I don't know if you've listened to it, but it comes across really clearly and it sounds great. You should definitely have your son listen.
Perfect. Give him some pointers.
So we're really thrilled today to have Lee Christie and Karen Zaka join us on the podcast. They had an incredible verdict that came out recently against Tesla in the state of Indiana, right?
Yes.
And I read, Lee, you had posted a kind of a summary of the case, and it really sounded like an epic saga from beginning to end, replete with Elon Musk personally insisting that the case be tried and the hiring of, it sounds like, very large number of defense lawyers, filing lots of motions, making arguments, and even spiraling into a fight outside in the parking lot between the lawyers. But can you guys just take us back and kind of tell us the story of the case and how it got from where it began to that epic trial that you described in that summary?
I'll get started just talking about getting the case in. I got the case in back in 2017 when Chris Dugan was struck on his motorcycle. I met with his mother, Anna Marie Dugan Norris. Chris was 37 at the time, and he was in the hospital with a severe traumatic brain injury, non-communicative, in a coma, and had just recently had his craniectomy where they removed part of his scalp. You get these cases in and you look at it. So you get the crash report and talk to the witnesses, and everything looked pretty solid in terms of a motorcyclist that exited a Speedway gas station onto a state highway that's a local road when it gets inside the perimeter of 465 here in Indianapolis. And it looks pretty normal. It looks pretty good from a liability standpoint because the driver of the other vehicle, which was a Tesla employee, was waiting to turn left into a lot next to the Speedway gas station that Chris Dugan had just exited. So Chris was in his lane of travel, had accelerated to under the speed limit to about 35 miles per hour. And the Tesla driver, which was in a Ford F-250, just turns left and broadsides him. I mean, literally, there's a white truck that is westbound that Chris follows, and he lets the white truck go by, and then the Tesla driver just broadsides Chris. All the witnesses were in our favor. There was some question of whether Chris stopped or not before exiting the speedway, but everything looked good. Severe traumatic brain injury, so you've got good liability and objective injuries. And as all you trial lawyers know, these are kind of cases that if you have a reasonable insurance company or risk management company, they look at their risk and exposure, and typically these cases will settle.
Emphasis on reasonable.
Yeah. So from a trial lawyer standpoint, you look at it and you think, okay, this is a good case. You got good clients, severe injuries. You wonder what the insurance limits are. And we found out that the driver of the vehicle itself was insured by Zurich for $2 million. But we knew Tesla, we found out Tesla owned the vehicle. So we thought, okay, there's probably an umbrella, an excess policy or something. We'll come to find out Tesla self-insured above $2 million. So you work it up, and we filed suit right away just to get discovery. And the issue became course and scope. That was a huge issue of whether the Tesla driver was in the course and scope, because he had taken this Ford F-250 home the night before and dropped off the trailer that he typically would pick up and deliver cars on to be repaired. And he had talked to his boss about, well, I'm closer to home, so can I just go on home from here instead of driving on the clock all the way back to the office or the maintenance center and then all the way back? So the boss said yes. And he leaves from home that morning, but he did clock in when he first got in the truck. And his rule was, if you clock in, once you get in the truck, you clock in immediately. You're on the clock. So we had a big issue with that. So as you guys know, you always have to work these cases up as if they're going to go to trial, even though this is the kind of case that probably should settle. All along, and after we brought Nick and Karen in, all of us just shake our heads constantly. Why is this case going to trial? It's a significant case, significant injury, good liability. It's probably not going to go to trial. But what we didn't calculate was the Elon Musk effect and the Tesla effect. What we found out, maybe Nick and Karen knew this, I didn't beforehand, of Tesla's penchant for just fighting everything, not wanting to settle and just pushing it on all ends. So we can get into that, talking about how many law firms they brought in. But we did, before I brought Nick and Karen in, worked it up, got the accident reconstructionist out there. He had a neurologist, had all that lined up and had all the witnesses and prepared all that for, may have to go to trial. The other kind of interesting thing about this, that Speedway gas station had 3 surveillance cameras. So our accident reconstructionist was able to get the surveillance camera, and we could see the surveillance of Chris coming into the speedway, inside the speedway, leaving the speedway, getting on his motorcycle and exiting the speedway. And then we could also see the truck. Now it's a little obscured because of trees and poles and things, but we could see the Tesla driver pull up and stop, wait for about 10 seconds, and then just make this left-hand turn and hit Chris. So we had that benefit. And all of that kind of just goes to, as you're looking at it, you're thinking, this is a clear liability case. I mean, there shouldn't be any dispute on this. Well, there was. So that kind of started the litigation. We had a local law firm. Oh, I will say this. So Zurich hired a really good defense attorney, a great guy here in town. And they hired him for both Tesla and the driver. Well, within a few weeks, they fired him and brought in 2 different law firms, one for Tesla individually and one for the driver individually. So at that point, we kind of knew the setup was going to be they're going to fight course and scope, because now they've got another group of lawyers representing the driver of the truck and a group of lawyers representing Tesla. Both of those law firms were in Indiana. And then the fight kind of began for a while about just discovery. And I started to see it was going to be an issue. We did file summary judgment on course and scope and won that. That was prior to getting Nick and Karen involved. That went, they asked for the Court of Appeals to review that, and the Court of Appeals declined to accept it. We also filed one other summary judgment on Chris Dugan did not have a helmet on. So I took the position, Tesla's lawyers wanted to inspect his helmet, and they filed a motion. I said, no, you're not getting the helmet. It's irrelevant, immaterial. And in Indiana, there's no mitigation of damages for lack of a seatbelt or helmet.
And Lee, we should probably let the listeners know, too, that in Indiana, there's no law requiring you wear a helmet as a motorcyclist either.
Right. So no law requiring wearing of a helmet, and no law that allows mitigation of damages for not using a helmet or not having a helmet on. For those that are familiar with Indiana, we have a Republican controlled supermajority in all areas. But this last session, starting July 1, now they're going to let the lack of a seatbelt come in for a mitigation of damages. I don't know if your states have a mitigation of damages for not wearing a seatbelt. We never did until this July. So probably a helmet will be next. They'll add a helmet to it if they ever change that law requiring a helmet. They filed a motion to compel. I responded to it, and the court ruled that no, they can't inspect the helmet because it's irrelevant. They asked for the Court of Appeals to accept that. The Court of Appeals declined to accept that. So now we're almost 2 or 3 years into the litigation, and it's really going nowhere. We had a couple trial settings that we got caught in COVID. Court moved it. And then we come to about 3 years ago when we're thinking there's another trial date coming up. And I talked to Nick Rowley and wanted Nick to get involved just because after I brought Nick in, they brought in another defense firm to associate with the local defense firm, which was, I don't know if you're familiar with Reminger. Reminger is a central United States kind of Midwest law firm. It's growing, does a lot of insurance defense work. And I think they're starting to grab business from a lot of good lawyers over to Reminger because of, I don't know how, you know, their rates or their marketing or whatever, but Reminger's starting to get a lot more cases. So that was it before we got Nick involved. I sent Nick an email and talked to him about the case. And like I mentioned to you guys, the hook, I think, for Nick was Tesla, because Tesla's a name that's going to draw some attention. And I was hoping that would be so, because I'm sure Nick gets so many requests to associate on cases that I was hoping he would see that and really take an interest in him. I had a settlement video that I'd done, as we all do, thinking this is just a normal case. Put your settlement to video together, show the surveillance, show the damages, interview the doctors, all those people, and show the lay witnesses, show the extent of the damages. So I sent that to Nick, and pretty quickly he said, yeah, we'll get on board, which thank goodness they did, because Nick and Karen, there's no way that my associate and I, Katie Marshall and I, there's no way we could have done it. It was just overwhelming what they started. And I don't know if they started it because Nick got involved. I really believe that it was going to be that way regardless. And they were hoping just be me. But we could not have done it without Karen and Nick and his team coming on board.
So Karen, you want to pick it up from there?
Sure. Reached out to Nick, and then Nick asked me to get involved, and I was happy to. One of the things that Lee and I first discussed when I first met Lee was some of the defense experts that had been disclosed and whether or not we should depose them. So they had disclosed a expert neurologist to testify. So our client, Chris, had a prior brachial plexus injury, which the brachial plexus, I don't know if the listeners know, but it's a bundle of nerves essentially between your neck and shoulder, and it controls your ability to move and lift your arm in various ways. And it's actually a common birth injury that we see a lot in med mal cases. But So he had a prior brachial plexus injury that impacted his ability to lift his right arm, but he still had, it was 4 out of 5 or 5 out of 5 grip strength and wrist strength. But that being said, he had to lift his arm to get it onto the handles of the motorcycle. So they had disclosed a neurologist to say that Chris's prior brachial plexus injury impacted his reaction time in the collision, and therefore he was at fault. That same neurologist was disclosed to testify that Chris had brain atrophy, alleging that was from a prior collision. And this brain atrophy was allegedly on radiology imaging, and their expert is the only person that identified this brain atrophy. There's no medical record saying that. No radiologist had ever said that. So strategically, Lee and I coordinated on this, that we thought it would be best to not depose the neurologist and instead get his opinions stricken because they were junk science. And when we argued it to the judge, I do think my background in medical malpractice helped a bit with this, talking about how the neurologist had no basis and there was no evidence of the specific type of brachial plexus injury Chris had that it would impact his reaction time. And also with the brain atrophy, everyone over the age of 30 has brain atrophy. It's a sad fact, but it happens to all of us as we age. And there was no explanation as to how a smaller brain specifically impacted reaction time. So we were able to persuade the judge that there was no logical nexus between what the expert was disclosed to say and the reaction time in the collision. His opinions were precluded and then limited to his report otherwise. And this worked out for us with their motorcycle safety expert too, as they tried to disclose a new theory at trial, saying that Chris was hidden in the shoulder or breakdown lane when he was pulling out of the speedway, which was an opinion that had never been disclosed before. And the judge successfully precluded them on that issue.
Let me jump in for a couple things, because this was maybe the listeners would appreciate this. This is a difference in practice of Nick Rowley's office and my office. Because when Karen got in and her partner, Barry Ducheneau, and Nick, they strategized a little differently than I did on what to do with defense experts. So we had their reports because they had disclosed them, but I was saying, okay, let me go get their depositions. Let me lock them in. And Nick says, no, don't take their depositions. We got the reports. If you take their depositions, they're going to argue more and support their opinions more, or maybe even come up with different opinions and foundations for those opinions.
Right.
And I said, no, I'm going to go take them because I want to lock them in. And he goes, no, don't take those depositions. Well, in retrospect, it really worked to our advantage because they were limited to those opinions in the reports, and they never supplemented with additional opinions. And particularly that one CT scan that their neurosurgeon said showed that Karen got excluded, but he pointed to one slide of a CT scan and he had an arrow on it and said, here's the atrophy in the brain of Chris Dugan back in 2015. Well, when I showed that to our treating neurologist, he said, well, you can't tell from one slide. Let me get the slides, the whole CT scan. I can look at all of them, the slides before and after. And he said, absolutely not. There's no atrophy there beyond no specific atrophy. So at trial, he did a really good job because we'll get to that when we talk about the trial, but they snuck that in with our neurologist and our neuropsych, but we handled it very well. And
those Daubert motions, did you have a hearing where the expert was cross-examined as part of that, or you just argued it from the report?
Just argued. And it's important to note too, because I know every state is different, but in Indiana, they're limited to reports. It's not just a notice issue. They can't expand at trial. So depending on the state, and obviously depending on the specific facts of the case, in this case, it worked out for us and it ended up being a good decision. But I wouldn't, as a blanket statement, recommend to any of our listeners to not depose experts.
Karen, on the motion relating to brachial plexus and atrophy and perception reaction time, how did the issue of duty come about? I mean, was the argument that plaintiff had a duty not to be on a motorcycle because he had a brachial plexus injury in the past?
They didn't argue it specifically in those terms, but that was definitely the implication. And when we fast forward to trial, that's going to be something that you'll hear they were weaving in to try to imply at times during cross-exam. But the actual argument coming from their side was that the motorcyclist had a duty to have a proper lookout and avoid the accident or collision if he could. And they were essentially saying that he could have avoided it if he had been able to brake properly, which the brachial plexus injury impaired him and the brain atrophy impaired him. But there was also no security footage to back up that he saw the Tesla truck before it broadsided him. And unfortunately, Chris doesn't have a memory of that day, given what happened to him and the traumatic brain injury. So there was no testimony from anybody that Chris saw the Tesla truck before it broadsided him either. So there was really no basis to say this brachial plexus injury or alleged brain atrophy impacted his perception reaction time.
Can somebody just describe the mechanics, kinematics of the accident? Because I'm having a hard time in my mind picturing what happened. He's pulling out of a gas station and the truck is coming along the road. Is that?
So we did have the surveillance video and we also did a animation because we knew that.
But I just want to, can the listener understand what happened? I don't think anyone's explained that yet.
Yeah, Rockville Road is a two-lane eastbound road and a two-lane westbound road. And it goes, it's a major road. It's Highway 36 as it gets outside of town. So it's a major intersection, major thoroughfare. And on the corner of Rockville and High School Road is a Speedway gas station. So, and that Speedway gas station, if you're eastbound, which this happened at 7:30 a.m., and the Tesla driver was going to turn left, he couldn't turn into the Speedway because there's a concrete median and a left turn lane. So he stops before the concrete median to turn left into the parking vacant parking lot next to it, and then he goes through. Well, Chris had been at the Speedway that morning, and he's coming out to go west to go to work. So he gets in the right-hand lane or the curb lane to go westbound, and the Tesla driver is eastbound turning left. So it's a standard left turn case, not quite at the intersection because he's shortcutting the intersection. Chris does stop. We see both experts, our accident reconstructionists and the defense accident reconstructionists, agreed that he did stop before he entered into Rockville Road to go westbound. And there was a white pickup truck that goes past him and he follows it out in the right-hand lane. And then back further is a red car in lane number two. So the Tesla driver sees the white truck. The sun's directly in his eyes. It's a bright sun. In fact, he testified to the police officer and in his deposition that the sun was in my eyes. I either blinked or blacked out because he said, I never saw him. When I hit him, when I broadsided him making that left turn, I thought I hit a brick wall. So he never saw anything. So Chris pulls out. The white truck goes by. Our theory is that this driver, Kazubas, his name, he shoots the gap. And there was testimony about gap acceptance between the white truck and the red car. It was about a 3 second or less gap. And our accident reconstruction said that's aggressive to pull out there. And he shoots the gap and never sees Chris. Now, his explanation was that he never saw Chris because either the sun was in his eyes. But what they developed was Chris pulled out at the exact time behind that white truck that he was invisible to the Tesla driver when he started his turn.
Invisible, impossible to see. That was their catchphrase from opening. Invisible, impossible.
Invisible, impossible. And we found out that they had done dozens and dozens of focus groups. When Quinn Emanuel got on it, maybe even the firm before Quinn Emanuel, they got on it and started to do these focus groups to try to see what resonates with the jury. And obviously, invisible, impossible must have been two words that they thought resonated with a jury. And really, Nick pointed out on cross that we're talking about less than 0.2 seconds that the motorcycle was behind the white truck where the Tesla driver couldn't see him. But to me, I always thought it was 100% liability. But I will say we did a big data focus group, and they came out between 16 and 30% liability on the motorcyclist. I've always thought that the only way Dugan gets fault is just some implicit bias of motorcycle riders. And the other thing is their expert, their accident reconstructionist, termed his pullout as aggressive, that Chris did an aggressive merge behind the white truck, and that aggressiveness made him invisible and impossible to see.
Was the trial bifurcated?
It was, yeah.
With that set of facts, how did the court decide to bifurcate it? Or was that elected by you guys?
I'll start, let Karen finish, because we objected twice to bifurcation and the court said no bifurcation. As we got, and twice we were within a day or two of trial, and we'll talk about the issue of why it went off. That issue is whether Chris Dugan was competent to testify or not competent. That became a real issue with both sides. But anyway, it went off, and this third time when we were scheduled in December, we're just a day or two away from trial, and it goes off again due to some defense motions. So we're set for March, which is when we went. And at that time, Nick kind of took the position that maybe on this case, bifurcation would be good for us. And I'll let Karen talk about that rationale.
Yeah. So, I mean, Nick's a big proponent of bifurcation if the case is right. And I do think this was the right case for it, especially given the brachial plexus injury and the brain atrophy, which we thought would be coming in at some point. We had some issues with Chris had some drinking problems post-injury. We were worried about that coming in, even though we were going to frame it the way we did, which is this is why he needs 24-hour supervision, because it's that much more important that he's not drinking when he has a traumatic brain injury. But I do think it made it cleaner. And one thing Nick has told me about why bifurcation is helpful is then you don't have jurors who are hung up on the money issue and fighting against you when it comes to liability because they're really hung up on the money issue. So it makes it a cleaner case.
It took us, our liability portion was 5 days, 4 days plus closing an instruction. So the liability took 5 days on a simple left turn case. They had our accident reconstructionist on the stand for 6 hours with direct and cross. They actually had him come back the next day with his computer program and a whole system, his big screen.
Full server.
Yeah, his full server to try and dig in. Really, they used it as a discovery to have him dig into some animations or recreations that he had done in coming up with the final animation that was done by DK Global.
I actually have the animation handy. Can I share a screen to show it to you guys? Maybe that would help.
It would be great to have it available for our listeners to watch it. So yeah, if you do that, we can make that available to people. We can put it on the website. Yeah, why don't you show it to us now and then we can flip it out.
And maybe, Karen, you can show there's parts of it that maybe you don't have to show. But
I'm just going to show the replay.
And there must have been, there was a dispute about whether the animation can be used. I'm sure they filed motions regarding this and you overcame
yes.
that.
Well, and here's the deal. We had our accident reconstructionist do some animations just based off himself, off the drone footage and the, you know, all the Faro system and all these systems that he has in the surveillance video. And those worked out pretty well. When right before the December trial, Nick thought we needed a better presentation of that animation. So we engaged DK Global to do what Karen's going to show. And there was a dispute. We didn't actually provide that to them until about a week before the March trial because they were finalizing it. That became an issue with them, obviously. But the court decided it was demonstrative, so we could show it and discuss it.
DK Global was very patient with us. We had a lot of lengthy meetings with us, with experts. They did a great job.
This will be particularly helpful for the audience and you guys, because you'll see what I was trying to describe audibly and verbally.
I don't see it. I don't know.
I don't see it either.
Oh, okay.
One of the issues here is that we're not on a Zoom platform and we have not actually shared video across this Squadcast platform before. So I don't know how well that works.
I'll send you guys the link.
Send me the link and we're going to upload that so that the listeners can watch that on the elevate.net.
It would be interesting to see what the listeners, who I understand are mostly all trial lawyers, think about the liability after they see the animation. And remember, when you look at it, the defense is pointing out that when Chris Dugan pulls out behind that truck, he pulls out too close to it and he hides himself by kind of cutting across the berm a longer period of time than he needed to get into the lane, because their motorcycle expert says, see and be seen. They stress that, see and be seen, and he should be seen as soon as he possibly can. So that was their argument. He could have been seen sooner by the Tesla driver, and if he had, maybe both drivers could have avoided it or tried.
One thing that helped the defense with that, too, is that our surveillance footage was a little pixelated, but also was in 1 second still frames.
Yeah.
So they would take that one still frame where Chris is behind the passing white truck and just kept hammering it with the jury. See, he's blocked by this truck, and really took it out of context. But I mean, I think ultimately it was probably effective.
I think it was, because they gave 30% fault.
Right.
That was the high end of our big data. And when we did our individual focus groups, it was the highest I think we got was 25% fault on the motorcyclist. So they did find the highest percentage. Honestly, my feeling was maybe we stressed the liability too much to prove how it was 100% liability. And we put so much emphasis on it, so much time into it, that this is speculation. Maybe the jury started thinking, wow, there's really something here, because we're spending 4 days dissecting milliseconds of a video. Karen's right. They would show that one slide, a screenshot, where he is behind the truck and behind the car, you know, that perfect angle. And so they came up with 30%. Obviously, I think it was a compromise. We did get one question from a juror when they did liability before the liability assessment. We've now figured out how that came about. A question from the jury said, does the liability assessment affect the damages?
Will the percentages affect next week?
Yeah.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show, that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com. So can you guys take us inside the courtroom now? Let's move on to the trial. First of all, who's the cast of characters that eventually assembled to defend this case on the other side of the table? And can you talk about how you guys divided up responsibilities and the different kind of milestones in the trial, openings, some of the key witnesses, closings? And then I understand there was a lot of drama surrounding deliberations.
There was. So I'll do the characters and Karen can kind of get into the trial strategy. So we had a firm that came in, the third firm, Yukovich Kavanaugh. And Nick is very familiar with Jim Yukovich. And actually, Nick was pretty optimistic the case would get settled after Yukovich got in there due to his relationship and due to Jim's discussion of value. So at one point, we made a demand to Yukovich of $22 million. And I don't know, but I think maybe Yukovich said that's in a range that we should settle the case, but Elon Musk said no. So that's just my insight.
And you guys were aware that Elon Musk was personally involved in making decisions regarding the settlement of this case? They were representing that to you on the other side?
From the very beginning, the local firm said, hey, it's not us, it's Elon Musk. And I said, this is crazy. And they kept saying, he believes Chris Dugan should accept personal responsibility for not wearing a helmet. And he wants to change Indiana law. And I said, well, he's never going to change Indiana law. That's up to the legislature.
Elon has his own history with a motorcycle crash. If you Google it, I think this might have been a little personal to him.
But that, you know, when I first heard this case, I had assumed that the reason he was so personally invested in it was because this was actually a Tesla vehicle and maybe implementing some of Tesla's technology. But in fact, it was a Ford truck that isn't even manufactured by Tesla. So it's hard to understand
right.
why they had...
Cybertruck competitor.
You'd almost think it might be good for him, but I mean, but this wasn't an autonomous vehicle. It wasn't any Tesla technology. It's simply Tesla's only connection was that the person who was driving happened to be employed by Tesla, right?
Right. That's right. And vicarious liability, which we ended up prevailing on. So Yukovich gets out. There was an issue of competency of Chris Dugan to testify. I had taken the position he was incompetent, which truthfully, he was for more than several years. I mean, he couldn't talk hardly at all, couldn't understand anything, couldn't comprehend. He did start to get better the last 2 years in his, maybe not some of his comprehension, because our neuropsych says he has the reasoning and intellectual ability of a 10 to 12-year-old and the speaking ability of a 5-year-old.
He's worked really, really hard.
He's worked really hard, which was Nick's kind of trial strategy. We need to get him in front of the jury. We decided, okay, we won't say he's incompetent. You can depose him. And they did. And the court had a hearing on it and determined after watching his deposition, he was incompetent. So the trial goes off and then Yukovich gets out and then they bring Quinn Emanuel and Fagery Drinker, which Fagery was there for appellate purposes, pretrial motions, all that kind of stuff. Quinn Emanuel comes on, and it's kind of a new, even the Yukovich firm did a lot, but when Quinn Emanuel came on, they just reduplicated everything, and the court let them redepose everybody. It was nonstop, taking depositions, supplemental depositions, and billing, a new discovery request, everything that we would fight, and most of the court would keep out, but a lot of it she let them do. So that gets us to the competency issue, which Karen can describe for December, and then the final competency issue, which brings us to the trial, which I think you guys want to hear because that's the strategy of the trial.
Yeah, to answer your original question, we had four lawyers on our side. It was myself, Nick Rowley, Lee Christie, and Katie Marshall. They added a folding table to the two tables that they had. So they had Asher Griffin from Quinn Emanuel, Michael Lifrak, Alex Bergjans and Elodie Thompson, and then 15 plus lawyers that were all huddled around them the whole time. I mean, it was like they had an entire law firm there. And they were filing motions while we're in court, examining witnesses.
And then there's a bunch of people outside the courtroom that you don't even see, right?
Right. Yeah.
All to try a left turn case involving a pickup truck on motorcycle.
Yeah, accident. We were trying to figure out how much money they were billing per hour, given how many lawyers were there. I'm sure it was a lot.
All right, so now let's move to the trial itself. Karen, tell us about that.
It was a battle, for sure. One aspect we haven't talked about yet is how often they moved for mistrial. At one point, Lee and I actually shared a notebook where we were tallying how many times in a 10-minute span they would move for mistrial. It was very clear from the very beginning that they were just doing everything they can to get a mistrial and appeal. I mean, it was nonsensical things that were prompting them to move for mistrial. So it was a very aggressive defense strategy.
And how did the judge respond to that?
We got really lucky. Our judge, Lee can speak more to this, but Judge Voorhees, she came out of retirement to handle this case. She's extremely intelligent, quick, is a trial lawyer, so knows how things go, lets you try your case, but was very, very patient and reasonable despite how aggressive defense counsel was towards her. I mean, there were times where their appellate lawyer was literally screaming at the judge, red in the face, screaming, and the judge was extremely patient, never showed any bias or frustration. I give her a lot of credit. I admire our judge greatly. She did a great job.
She was always trying, and she would say this. She said she would try to protect the record. She said, I'm putting this on the record. I want there to be a clean record and that this case doesn't get overturned on appeal. I mean, she would say that several times. So, yeah, Quinn Emanuel and Fegri had their whole trial team there. The one thing that Nick fought for really hard was to get Chris Dugan. He really felt the jury needed to see Chris and hear him because he is just a delightful young man. And we probably disagreed on that because I thought, you know, Nick wanted him. If you've tried a case with Nick or haven't, if you know Nick, he's a force. And he got it. He wanted Chris to testify in liability, and judge reversed herself the morning of the liability section of the trial, right before opening, and said, I'm going to let him testify only to his habit and custom because he didn't have any recollection. But the jury did get to hear about 10 or 15 minutes of Chris Dugan. So I think they got to see what type of person he was. And Nick wove in a little bit about, you know, how to operate a motorcycle and that kind of stuff. So I think he tried to get in there, stay within the court's bounds. But my opinion, the real reason was to let the jury see Nick Dugan before they got to damages.
Well, so in Indiana, evidence of individual habits admissible. In some states, it's not. Like in Massachusetts, where I'm primarily based, it's not admissible. So that was some good law in our favor. So that even though Chris didn't have an actual memory of the collision, he could testify. He had been riding motorcycles for over 20 years. He knew how to brake. He knew to look both ways before exiting a gas station, things like that.
What do you think the major turning points or most significant elements were in the trial?
What stands out to me is Nick's cross of the defense motorcycle safety expert, Steve Garrett. Just that poor man. When he left the stand, I think he was thinking, I'm never going to testify again.
What did he do in that examination that was so effective?
One thing that stood out to me about the cross of him was Garrett's, their expert, had testified on direct about perception reaction time, like we were talking about earlier, and saying that there wasn't any evidence that Chris did anything to avoid the collision. And he said, you know, you would have seen him, his body language would have changed. He would have raised his shoulders and leaned forward or backwards. And on cross, Nick gets up. And like I said, our surveillance footage was very pixelated. And it's just these 1 second still frames. And Nick pulls up the surveillance footage and zooms in and is like, okay, can you point out to us where you see his shoulders and elbows? You said he would do this and raise his arms and all these things. And visually to everyone in the courtroom and probably anyone watching on CBN, you just see this pixelated blob. You can't discern body parts or anything. And he just lost all credibility pointing to this very pixelated blob saying, oh yeah, he's not lifting his shoulders here. It was wonderful to watch.
Nick really has an ability to put his notes aside and just get right down there with the witness and dissect what he's saying and understand it. And I think Nick's two or three steps ahead of, certainly he's two or three steps ahead of me, but two or three steps ahead of the expert because he knows where he's leading him. And he led him right into that. And then he expanded it. And as Karen said, I mean, if you're looking at it, it's like one of those ink blot tests. You couldn't see ahead from a motorcycle, really. You couldn't even tell unless you knew it was a motorcyclist on a motorcycle. So he lost all credibility there. To me, that was one of the things that stood out. I thought our accident reconstructionist did a really good job talking to the jury and explaining things. The problem was he was up there so long and they focused in on these little tiny things that they kept him up there so long. I think maybe his effectiveness was lost because it just got lost in 6 hours. But I will say this, they did not call their accident reconstructionist because...
But we were ready for him.
He would not have come off well.
We were excited for him.
Yeah, and we had bets whether they would call him or not. They had a few experts we were kind of betting back and forth. Do you think they'll call him? And I think Karen and I were pretty much on board. They're not going to call that guy.
Yeah.
They're not going to call this their neuropsych either.
The other point that was memorable to me was the damages closing. Nick did a great job, but also defense stood up and they had stipulated to about $4.5 million in economics, but they were disputing the 24-hour care. But defense actually said in closing, here's the economics we've stipulated to, about 4.5, 4.6, and that the non-economic should be half that.
Right.
And that blew my mind, even for a defense lawyer, given everything the jury had heard about Chris and heard from his family and former employer and ex-wife, ex-girlfriend. I think defense lost some credibility themselves arguing that.
And mind you, they had never stipulated to anything until that very, well, an opening they kind of alluded they might stipulate, but they had never stipulated to anything to us.
No.
Until that minute. You ask a question, Ben, about division of duties. Well, with Nick, it's hard to figure the division of duties because I had things planned out and we, Karen and I and Nick and the whole team would divide up the witnesses and we knew who was going to take who's going to do this part of closing, that part of rebuttal or whatever. Well, it doesn't always go that way with Nick. He takes over and does such a good job that I was more than fine with it, but he really does take over and do the lion's share, at least he did on this trial. And well, for example, all of us kind of agreed that I, as the hometown person, should do the rebuttal closing, just give it the common sense Hoosier, here's what we do in Indiana type thing. And some of Nick's team had written out some really good, Steve Holt, you may have had him on before, know him, had written out some good things to say. And so I was excited, ready for that. Well, Nick said, when Nick's done with his part and we're coming up, he says, no, no, I'm doing rebuttal closing. And he did a fabulous job because he dissected their damage stuff. Right? He just ate it up on their, like Karen was saying, their assessment of damages. He did the one thing you've probably seen before. I've seen versions of it, the briefcase.
The man in the black suit.
Yeah, the black suit.
Yeah.
And Nick did a really good job. I don't know. Karen and Nick have this ability to, while witnesses are on, they're creating slides to use with that witness, or right, they're going to put it right in their closing and just punching it out. And then all of a sudden they use it in closing, you know, 7 minutes later.
You got to take pictures of defense slides while they're up there and then airdrop it to your Mac and put it in a keynote.
So that's probably a difference in just the trial strategy with Nick's office and my office is I really have things planned out. Kind of know what I'm going to ask, know what witness order we're going in. Well, Nick changes that up on the fly. You can tell him, Karen, I think maybe we could tell this about his decision to call the driver's girlfriend. You think we want to talk about that?
No, I don't think we need to get
to that. We don't need to talk about that. But it's just, there's lots of things in this trial and we'll finish up probably with deliberations. But Nick handled the lion's share. Karen handled the lion's share of prepping Nick to the best she could. I did some witnesses and some of closing. Katie did a witness. Our damage witnesses were phenomenal. They didn't even cross, I would say, most of them. Oh, you should probably tell them about our neuropsych. So here's another thing Nick did. I had a neurologist that was really good, hard to pin down because he's just a teaching, treating neurologist. He's not a paid, doesn't even like, this first time he ever testified in court. Well, when Nick got involved, we decided we needed another expert, which was a neuropsychologist, woman by the name of Polly Westcott here in town, and she did phenomenal.
Yeah, phenomenal expert, great at testifying. Recommend her highly to anyone looking for a neuropsych.
Yeah, she really brought the functionality of Chris Dugan and this argument about 24/7 care. Nobody had said 24/7 care until Polly Westcott saw him in January of 23. Was the first time anybody said 24/7. So that became a $6 million difference, you know, in the life care plan from 4 point something to 10 point something. She did great. Neurologist did great.
Why don't we get to the deliberations, which I understand were drama filled.
We could finish with, before we get that, go to Nick's closing and then Nick getting up during and objecting during defense closing.
Sure, let's do that.
Because they violated a motion in limine to bring, they really wanted this prior crash to get in about the brachial plexus, the head injury and all that stuff from a prior crash. in my opinion, they violated a motion limiting. And Nick jumps up and really goes after him. And she releases the jury. And then one of the attorneys from Quinn Emanuel called Nick a liar.
Oh, yeah.
That set Nick off.
Yeah, Nick said, did you just call me a liar? And he said, yeah, you're a good liar.
And he said, I want this on the record. I want you to admit it on the record right now that you called me a liar and you blah, blah, blah. Then Nick invited him to meet him in the hallway. So Nick comes back in and he's pretty hot. And I said, let me take the rebuttal because you're too hot. I mean, you just need to calm down. Let me do the rebuttal. I've got it planned out. And he just looks at me and smiles. He goes, no, I got this. So in a way, I know he was offended, but
he knew the intention was to try to rattle him. Oh,
yeah, I think so. And he's always under control of what he's doing. Yeah, he knows what he's doing. He doesn't. Yeah, I don't think he flies off the handle.
No,
not knowing anything. He knows. So we get through closing. I thought defense closing was very mediocre or less on damages. I mean, really, really mediocre. They're closing on liability. My wife was in the audience. She's known this case for 7 years. She's been in the legal field. She said, I was worried that it might be 50-50, or they might find that he didn't do anything wrong, because Zuba didn't do anything wrong. It was impossible to see him.
If they had found Chris 51% at fault, we would have lost.
So I thought that the Quinn Emanuel lawyer closing and liability was excellent. I think Nick agreed with that and Karen agreed with it. His closing on damages was mediocre or less. At one point, Nick had said, give $5 million a year for the rest of his life and, you know, explained everything he's been through. And at one point, the defense lawyer said, well, no, Chris Dugan would never take $5 million a year. Nobody would. And I thought, wow, well, that's pretty good for us.
Yeah.
So then the jury goes out. There's six and one alternate. And we're just sitting. Nick left right afterwards because he had to get back for things. He's always got something going on. So it's Karen and I and our team, and we're in a conference room. And about, 2 hours later, we get the first question or...
Yeah, jury went out, I think it was at 11:37. And I think around 2 o'clock, the bailiff came in and told us there was a request for a different calculator because the calculator the jury had didn't have enough digits.
Wow. That's the best question ever.
Yeah, that was pretty exciting. But then about an hour after that, they requested dinner for 6 p.m. So then I was kind of like, well, what's going to take them that long? And then a little while after that, that same juror sent a note to the judge saying essentially he's made up his mind and he's not going to change his mind. So that resulted in the court having that juror come in. And meanwhile, as all this is happening, defense is moving for mistrial. I think they even moved for mistrial when he requested insulin. So that resulted in the court having that juror come in. And meanwhile, as all this is happening, defense is moving for mistrial.
Everything, yeah.
I think they even moved for mistrial when he requested insulin.
They did.
So the judge brings him in, asks him questions about the note. He says, I'm a Marine. I'm not changing my mind for anybody. Tesla moves for a mistrial again. The judge inquired with the foreperson to say, you know, have you reached an impasse? The foreperson said, basically, I'm not sure. So then the foreperson got brought in and asked questions by the judge about, are you at an impasse? The foreperson told the judge, there's one juror who's basically refusing to participate. And Tesla again moved for a mistrial. The judge gave the whole jury a charge saying, you know, it's your duty to deliberate. And then couple hours after that, there was a note sent in by that same insulin juror that said, I have PTSD. And then another juror sent a note saying, it's getting hostile in here. What should we do? Which, love hearing that. Tesla moved for a mistrial again. The judge sent another note saying, well, have you reached an impasse? The foreperson said, we have.
One thing, Karen, that same juror, when he said he has PTSD, he said, and I'd like to be replaced by the alternate.
That's right. Yeah. He requested that the alternate take a spot.
And the judge said, sent back the instruction, alternate cannot replace a juror, continue to deliberate if you can do so. And then we did argue that PTSD might allow the judge to replace him because that was an illness, the same as the flu or COVID or something. If you got sick and you couldn't stay there.
You got five other people cornering you and you have a history of PTSD. I mean, I agree with you, which that is a medical issue, but.
Is it required to be a unanimous verdict?
Yes. Set of six. Yep.
So I will tell you this, this juror number one was a black guy, Marine, unemployed, cared for his mother. And at one point during voir dire, he had said, sometimes human suffering is just part of life or something to that.
Or God's plan or something like that.
God's plan. Oh, very religious guy. Very religious. So when we found out that he's the holdup, my immediate reaction was, this guy is probably low. He don't want to give any money because that's God's plan. But Nick on voir dire, the first voir dire, had kind of given him a signal that they were served. You know, they were both, was Nick a Marine?
He was in the Army.
Yeah. So he kind of said, you know, I served also. Thank you for your service or something. And when he came in and asked for the insulin, and we agreed to provide the strips for him. But all along, I'm thinking he's low, low, low. He's keeping us out. So the PTSD note comes out. It's getting hostile, gets out. She then says, go ahead, Karen.
Well, the judge says she's inclined to grant a mistrial, given that the jury's reached an impasse. And when the judge goes back to tell the jury this, they protest and say, no, we want to keep deliberating. But we've thought, so we're sitting in the courtroom thinking, all right, we've got a mistrial. We'll have to retry both phases. And the judge comes back in and says, new development. The jury has decided to continue to deliberate. And it was interesting to watch the, you know, the Quinn Emanuel lawyers had basically been celebrating, like all smiles, all 20, 30 of them, all smiles. And then the judge comes back in and says that, and it's just...
They went nuts.
Down faces and then, yeah, and then getting very aggressive.
They accused the judge of being coercive with the jury.
Yeah.
And the poor judge, she was mad, but she was also hurt. And she just kind of looks down for a minute or two, not saying anything. And then she told them, she said, that hurts me. I did not do anything coercive. I didn't, the bailiff assured it. And they're yelling. And I think she finally walked off the bench because they're screaming and yelling that they have to have a mistrial. And she's violated the duties of a judge by going back into the jury room.
Yeah. And then the verdict came in maybe a half hour after that or 40 minutes after that. And the judge pulled each individual juror, asked them each 2 to 3 questions about, is this your true verdict? Were you coerced in any way? Were you pressured in any way? She really protected the record with that. They all answered no.
What was the verdict?
So it was 60,687,491 and then reduced by 30%. So it was approximately 42 million.
Woohoo!
Congratulations.
Nice job. I love a happy ending.
Yeah.
They had come to us after closing. I was walking down the hall and Tesla Group said,
oh, yeah.
What's your final number? And I said, 50, which Nick had said that 50 million. And they laughed. And I said, well, you've never made an offer above 5.5 million. And they said, well, if you come under 10, we'll take it to Elon. And I just said, no, never mind. And walked out. And then they were deflated with that verdict.
I think that's going to be the banner quote for this show. If you get under 10, I'll take it to Elon.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, guys, we've been going just about a little bit over an hour. We try to keep it to that. And we really, really appreciate you coming on and telling us this story of this fascinating case and amazing result you achieved in it. Congratulations again.
It's fantastic.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having us. We really
appreciate it. Yeah, thank you.
And listeners, if you would like to watch the DK Global animation recreation video, we'll post that at elevate.fm, ELAWVATE.FM. So you can go there and find the video. And thanks again, guys.
Thanks so much. Congratulations.
All right. Thanks, Ben and Raul.
Thank you.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.